Hello and welcome to the latest in our podcast series of Executive Career Chats, where we talk to the great and the good of the C-suite about them and their roles as leaders in business. I'm your host, John Holton, an associate partner for Page Executive in our finance business. And I'm joined today by Hiroki Takeuchi, who's CEO and founder of GoCardless, and our own CEO, Steve Ingham from Page Group. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
No problem. So there's a couple of things that link you. You're both obviously CEOs. And also something more personal that you've both got in common is you both had accidents that have obviously sort of impacted you physically. And am I right in thinking, and Steve, if we come to you first, that it's actually through those that's how you met. Is that right?
Yeah, it's exactly how we met. I came out of hospital 2 years ago. And Hiroki was the first person I met in a wheelchair that wasn't in hospital. And it was.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you were. And I remember Sarah, my fiance, coming home and finding us sort of in effect sitting there in our wheelchairs, knee to knee, talking about not only being CEOs, but also the fact that, you know, clearly we'd gone through the challenges. So whilst everybody will think there's a young, good looking, clever bloke and an old, wrinkly, not so clever bloke, they got it right. But so whilst I might be the wiser CEO, he's very much the wiser wheelchair user. So it's great to be able to talk to somebody about what he'd been through and how he was dealing with life on the outside. And it's quite a big thing when you come out of hospital after 4 months.
What about you, Hiroki? What are your recollections of first meeting Steve?
Well, I remember just being kind of a bit flabbergasted by how positive Steve was, and also how he was taking everything in his stride, because as Steve said, that, you know, it's a big transition when you're learning to navigate the world and, you know, live life in a wheelchair. It's quite a big change, right? And when you're in hospital, you're a little bit kind of wrapped in cotton wool. Everything's a little bit, I guess, you're kind of divorced from reality, right? And so it's almost like being let back out into the wild, and you don't really know, you know, how to navigate the curbs and all the, you know, surfaces aren't smooth, and so you know, it's a bit of a shock to the system, or at least it was for me. And I remember meeting Steve and being like, wow, you know, I thought I'd kind of dealt with it quite well and quickly, but you know, this was another level.
And that's something that we'll return to later on, actually, around sort of that, I suppose, your stories around that and your reintegration into work and so on. And there's a lot of things to talk about. Hiroki, if we can just talk about you and your story to where you are, though, now as a CEO and your journey through to being a leader in your business. Would you just tell us a little bit about that journey?
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, I kind of cheated. So, you know, I'm the CEO of a company that I founded. So I founded GoCardless just over 10 years ago. And, you know, I guess I was quite fortunate in the sense that I had my injury, it's coming up to 5 years now, you know, it was September 2016. And at that point, we were already 5 years into the journey of GoCardless. And so, you know, we had a team, the company was growing, it got to a scale where it could operate without me being there. And, you know, I had a very, very supportive board, set of investors, team, family, friends that, you know, enabled me to basically, you know, take the time that I needed to, you know, deal with my injury, you know, go through initially the recovery, then rehab, et cetera, et cetera, knowing that there was a job for me to go back to. And, you know, that was incredibly helpful because, you know, it is a big shock and a big challenge, and your mind is not really there, you know, in terms of, you know, thinking about things like work. You're kind of thinking, okay, well, you know, how do I get up this curb? And so, you know, I took a bunch of time out, but was able to go back to work initially on a gradual basis, right? I didn't go straight back to full time. And then over the period of probably took me about a year and a half before I was really fully back full time. Have been able to be fortunate enough to continue the journey since as my role of CEO.
You said you sort of cheated in that you founded a business and now you're CEO of it. But and Steve, I'll come on to you and your journey in a second around this to sort of compare and contrast. But Hiroki, were you always destined to be a CEO? I mean, if you look back at, you know, your education, your upbringing, and so on, was that always kind of where you thought you'd be in business and in your career?
I don't know. I think it's hard to answer that in hindsight. The reason I say I cheated is because I don't think you would ever hire me to be the CEO of the company, right? You know, especially the way I think about it, I'm always like the least experienced person in the organization because, you know, I'd never managed a team of even five people when we first started. So, you know, now we're what, 500, just over 500 people. You know, I've never managed a company of that kind of scale either. And so I'm constantly learning, right? And it's a real privilege I see because, you know, I'm able to have this role and, you know, learn on the job in a way that maybe you wouldn't be able to if you hadn't founded a company. And so I didn't really think of, you know, my career and what I wanted to be in the context of like CEO or any kind of position like that. I was just super excited about the idea of building a business and starting something from scratch. And, you know, that's what led me down this path. And, you know, it's only later on when you're building the business and it's scaling it that you realize what you've signed up for. But by then it's a bit late, isn't it?
Steve, obvious question. Would you hire Hiroki? I mean, he's set out that apparently he'd be no use at much other than building his own very successful business. Would you have him?
Definitely. More the other way. I think it's more the other way around. I mean, our careers do have a bit of a parallel. There's just about 25 years difference in age between us, that's all. And so I'm just a bit further down the track. But in some ways, because although I didn't start Michael Page, and that's fairly obvious in the name, isn't it? But, you know, I joined Page when it was only about 240 people worldwide. So, you know, in our terms, we're now 7,000. Relatively small. And so, you know, I joined a business that recruited accountants in the city and had just opened an office in Sydney, which a lot of British companies tend to choose to do. And we'd open an office in Paris. And that was the summation of what we had. Whereas today it's transformed. And like Hiroki, I suppose, I've grown up as the business has evolved into a bigger business. And therefore, a lot of the skills, if I've got any, that basically have been developed on the job. You know, I've been 35 years at Page, and so pretty well most of what I've learned in the business world is been at Page as it's evolved through all the changes and the international development. You know, now 37 countries. I think what Hiroki said there, though, I mean, it, you know, about coming out of the institution of hospital and you know, suddenly realizing all these challenges are now very real. You know, my opportunity to talk to somebody like Hiroki and others, you know, who are further down the track, you know, his injury was 5 years ago. Mine was, you know, 2 years ago. And, you know, how do you do it? So it's like practical things, you know. To me, it was curbs, obviously, and how do you get in and out of your car and build your own chair and all of these different things. But then it was like, well, what about long haul flying? And you know, because Hiroki does it in his stride now and, you know, jumps on a plane and flies to Australia or whatever. I'm thinking, wow, you know, how do you manage the time difference? I mean, I've always been to Australia lots of times, but how do you manage that when you're disabled, and how do you manage a long flight? You know, there's some very practical problems when you're in a wheelchair. They won't let you have your wheelchair on the plane for a start. So, of course, without a wheelchair, we can't really move around. So it's not like we can just suddenly go up to the galley and ask for some food. Or, you know, we have the buzz and clearly as well, we won't fit into the toilets on a plane. So, you know, you do have to think of a lot of practical things as to how to cope. And that's why I've always enjoyed, you know, apart from the CEO similarity, I've always enjoyed talking to Hiroki.
Just going back a little bit, and there's a million questions there around airplane toilets that sort of spring into to their head, to be fair, which is fascinating. But when you joined, Stephen, as you say, you know, you've been CEO ever since I've been with the business, and it was very, very different then, and a lot different, as you say, when you joined. But when you joined, did you have the aspiration to lead the business?
You know, I think this is really difficult to answer as well. And I know what Hiroki said earlier, he's absolutely right. I'm hugely ambitious. And so it was a relatively small business. So I don't think now, looking back with hindsight, it sounds hopefully too arrogant to say, yes, I was very ambitious to try to get to the top. That was probably the summation of what I, you know, recognized as a vision for myself. But and there was a period, actually, in the middle of my career where I actually said, I don't want to be CEO. I mean, that, and then I changed my mind as my children got older, but it was all around trying to balance what was a heavy itinerary at work with a lot of travel and so on, a lot of nights away, with having a young family, and being CEO was only going to make that worse. So I did actually, for quite a few years, sort of bow out from, I want to get to the top. I want to get near to the top, but I don't want to do that much travel because I've also want to be successful bringing up a family.
Yeah.
And but as the kids got older and more independent and so on, I was able to put myself back in the race. And by then, I suppose I was making a decision where, you know, I'm on the main board. Could I make that final step up to CEO? Was it my duty? Was it my responsibility? Have I got the capability, I suppose? All of those things.
That, just coming back on something that both of you have mentioned there, and Steve, if you sort of go first on this, but that natural ambition and drive to want to get somewhere and want to get to the top, and Aroki, you talked about sort of the excitement and wanting to build a business and so on, which inevitably takes a lot of effort and a particular mindset. How has that naturally transferred to how you've dealt with the accidents that you've had and how you've dealt with the recovery, would you say, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, you know, both of us are family men, and I've got three daughters, but there's a big difference in the age and the ages of our children. And my kids were very young adults, I suppose. Well, one was probably still just about deemed a kid, 17. But you know, the eldest was about 25. And you know, for me, I'm a role model, I hope, to them. And that's the most important role model I have. I'm a good role model at work as well. But my priority as a father when I had the accident, you know, or was as a father when I had the accident. And so I wanted to make them proud. And, you know, I get a bit emotional talking to them, talking about them, because it was the worst thing about my accident. It wasn't, you know, I can't walk anymore, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I'm very lucky. My accident happened late in life. I've achieved quite a lot on my legs. But the impact and the scary situation I put my kids, looking at me on a life support machine in a coma, you know, I don't want to cause pain with my own kids. I mean, it's an awful thing. And I realized, you know, the doctors were saying to the kids, you know, in Switzerland, when your dad wakes up, he may not be the same man, because we're not sure that he's got a brain injury. And no comments from either of you. You know, the reality is that, you know, I they didn't know. I mean, they knew I'd taken a blow. My helmet was dented. But until I actually woke up and came out of the coma and spoke, then, so you can imagine, you know, your kids are looking at you and thinking, this is our father. And that's just a horrible thing to put your kids through, which was my biggest concern. So I wanted to show there was no problem. We had an immediate challenge with my eldest daughter getting married, you know, and she was saying, I'm going to delay it, cancel it, which of course would have put it straight into the middle of COVID, probably, because she got married in August 2019. My accident was in March. And so she kept phoning the physios and so on and saying, look, you know, when I finally got back to the UK, will he be OK? Will he be strong enough? Because he keeps saying he will be. But, you know, will he be? Will he be pain-free enough and so on? And I kept racing down to the physios and making sure I briefed them on the answer. And so that I could, you know, escape in July from hospital and be at, you know, stand up on my daughter's wedding and give her away. That was really, really important to me. So, yes, I think that drive, that ambition, that determination, you know, which you have to have as a leader, came through. Hopefully as an example to my kids, but as you know, John, hopefully as an example to my staff as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I kept in touch, I did videos and so on. I told everyone what I was going through and I'm very open about it. But, you know, you do need a lot of determination and resilience, and also, sort of, to be honest, physical fitness. And I know Aroki was fit when he had his accident, but, you know, for an old boy, I was pretty fit as well. And boy, oh boy, has that helped me enormously through this whole recovery, which is ongoing.
And Hiroki, how would you kind of compare, I suppose, yeah, the your mentality as yeah, somebody who's made it to the level you're at and started a business, so on, and your recovery in comparison to kind of Steve's experience there?
Yeah, I mean, I think I a lot of similarities, really. You have to be determined. You have to be ambitious. I think that in order to start a business and also in order to lead, and I think those qualities were quite helpful when it came to trying to recover as well, and deal with the injury that you've got. And that in it's interesting. I don't know how you found this, Steve, but I actually kind of enjoyed the rehab. It was like you have these super concrete goals. And I remember, literally like a day after my injury, it was like, okay, well, let's write a goal board. And we had like a whiteboard in the hospital room, and it was like, sit up for a minute, do this, do that, and super simple stuff. I mean, I remember like in the first, I completely lost my appetite after my injury, and so it was like eat 1,000 calories in a day. That was one of them, and it was just what feels like, in looking back on it, like trivial stuff, but at the time felt like really a really big deal. And I actually got quite a lot of satisfaction out of having those concrete goals and trying to beat them. I think that was really important. But I think the other thing that's super important as well, and that is really, I feel very lucky to have been able to have this, is the support of those around me, right? Because as much as you can be determined and push through this kind of an experience, I think it's really hard to do that if you're on your own, right? Steve, you were talking about your kids, and I think back up to how my wife, my family, my friends were all kind of coming round to support me. I think in the time that I was in hospital, I don't think I ever spent, I don't even think I spent any time at all on my own, like the whole time I was there. They kind of just blew away all the visiting hour requirements and all that kind of stuff, and just somehow managed to sneak someone in the whole time. So I was just kind of surrounded by a lot of support. And I think that's something that's equally important as well. And in some ways there's a lot of parallels to building a business, right? In the sense that, you have to be determined, you have to be ambitious, but you also need that support around you as well, right? I don't think anyone is able to do these things on their own. And whether it's the support of your team, the support of your family, the support of your friends, I think it's that's a key factor in all of this.
Totally.
Just, Steve, I know for you it was a skiing accident that you had, wasn't it? Hiroki, would you tell us a little bit about what actually happened with your accident?
Yeah, mine was a cycling accident. So it was actually in Regent's Park in London. I was just doing laps of the park, and then I collided into a car, which was completely my fault. I don't know what happened. Like, just a lapse of concentration at I guess the worst possible time. It was obviously all a bit of a blur, but fortunately, it was just outside the US ambassador's house. So there was like police there, watching me crash. And so they were able to kind of run over and get me assistance. And I was really fortunate to have just such amazing care, right? I was in an ambulance and at the hospital in Paddington within minutes, and then had a surgery within hours. And even though I'm not sure how much of a difference it made to the end outcome, right? I'm kind of paralyzed, and there's not much more you can do about that. But knowing that I had that, the best possible care, I think it helps you to not dwell on things, right? I think what's dangerous with these kind of things, situations, is when you start to wonder what could have been if something had gone differently, right? If you'd have had better care, would you have recovered more? That kind of stuff. I'm not burdened by that, and I think that makes a big difference as well.
How quickly as well, and Stephen, I know in terms of your accident, actually sort of, and I read this in an interview, Rogi, that your mind during the recovery, so when you woke up, quite quickly turned back to work as well as the family side of things. And then you kind of had a mini board meeting almost very, very quickly during your recovery. Is that right? Was that natural that your mind because you were in the middle of a sort of a startup business, or you know, that it very quickly returned to work?
I think it was almost like a the best way to describe it was like a spasm, right? In the sense that initially I was like, oh crap, like I've missed all these meetings I had in my calendar, like someone needs to let them all know. It's really practical stuff, and you know, and then obviously, you know, you're still kind of digesting the magnitude of what's happened, right? So you don't really when someone tells you you're never going to walk again, that's not something that you just like internalize straight away, right? You don't just go, oh yeah, fine, I guess I live in a wheelchair for the rest of my life. No, you're kind of in shock. So you know, I think, you know, a lot of that was just, you know, getting my co-founder and, you know, letting them know what had happened at work, letting the board know that, you know, I was going to be out for a while, but also that I was fine, you know, mentally. And, you know, I think, but then after that, for me, I definitely went through a bit of a phase where I was just like, that, like, I can't really think about work, right? And I didn't really think about work, and I was, and this is kind of goes back to the point about having that support. You know, I was super lucky because they gave me that space, right? They just made it clear that they were going to look after the company, they were going to make sure that we continue to do the things that we needed to do, and that they'd be waiting for me when I was ready to come back. And you know, that meant that I was able to focus on my recovery, you know, getting out of hospital, all of these things. And, you know, to be honest, there was definitely a period, and this was something that actually struck me about meeting you, Steve, was like, I didn't get the sense that you went through this in the same way, but like, for me, there was a period where I was like, I don't know if I'm going to go back to work. You know, I don't know if I can. And, you know, it was only after, I was in hospital for like 3 months, and even coming out of hospital 3 months later, I still wasn't really sure, right? I was scared of going back. You know, you're still trying to figure out so many basic things in life that it's hard to imagine that, you know, you go back to working. And so, you know, I needed a bit of encouragement, let's put it that way, to kind of go back to work.
What was your experience, Steve? How, obviously, you sort of spoke in there, your first thoughts about your family and your children and so on, but you're also the CEO of a, you know, FTSE listed business. At what point did your mind start to think about that and kind of return to the responsibilities that you therefore have in that role?
I think Hiroki said a very important thing, and that is that the support around you during your rehab is massively important. And I've been in touch with a lot of people who've had accidents like ours in the last year.
I don't even know how you get through that. Like, that's something that I've thought about a lot.
Literally people who've, I mean, there was a young kid that I was told about who was in one of the most famous orthopedic hospitals, and you know, his injury is this sort of level, C5, and you know, really, really difficult. He had a bit of an infection, was put back on a tracheotomy, and then caught COVID and wasn't even allowed to see his mum. And I just, you know, trying to deal with that thing that's so transformational in your life. You know, I know another gentleman at the other end of the scale who fell through the roof of a barn, because he's a farmer, and he broke his back, and, you know, he was given a pack of sandwiches for each meal every day, and he wasn't allowed to see anyone in his family. How you get your head around what's happened to you when you're totally isolated like that is really challenging. In terms of myself, I mean, when I was in hospital for a similar amount of time, my accident was in Switzerland, so obviously my operation was all there. And again, you know, what Hiroki said about being in safe hands, I guess if you had to pick a country that you're going to have an accident in, you know, Switzerland's not a bad one. They make great watches, yes, so they presumably can fix the metal in your back. But, you know, of course, I wanted to get back from Switzerland to be closer to my friends and family and so on. So, you know, I wasn't going to have a huge amount of visitors. My daughters were out there, obviously. They flew straight out there, my sister. And in fact, my closest friend flew out there as well. But, you know, I knew if I was back in the UK, I'd get more visitors. And similarly, having people from work and people from outside of work coming in to see you was really good. I suppose because I'd just done the job for so long, it felt very comfortable going back into work mode. You know, I was getting so many messages from Paige, you know, so many messages support saying, look, you know, we'll see you back in Oz, we'll see you back in New York, whatever, you know, and you know, that was really motivational. I got sent poems, songs, you know, all sorts, cards, you know, and food parcels, which is, you know, I don't mind. And it was, you know, so I always had that support from friends. And I know it's a bit weird, but I sort of mixed the two. You know, if I remember having my 50th birthday and, you know, a few friends went on tour and went playing golf, and half of them were from Page and half of them were from outside of Page, because I've been at Page so long. I mean, you know, can't work at a company for 35 years and not have some close friends there. So I guess mine merge a bit. And so people were telling, you know, they'd come round on a Saturday or a Sunday and they start talking about, so what's happening, you know, and they tell me all about work and what was going on and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I just started to get back into work while I was in hospital. And in fact, we had a trading update from the boardroom in the hospital, you know, which I sort of insisted I'd missed one. I didn't want to miss a second one. So I started getting involved. I went to a couple of board meetings around Aylesbury, which we found hotels that could just about do that. I had a European board meeting in Waddesdon, I think it was called. And then we had another one in Tring with the main board. So I've sort of, I guess I just integrated back into the workplace. But it is important to say there was one incident or one call that sort of made me feel very different about it. I mean, I was chatting to a chap who used to work at Page 1,000 years ago, he's slightly disabled now. And he said, so when you get out, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm going to go to my daughter's wedding. I obviously don't want to miss a, you know, Rugby World Cup in Japan. and I said, you know, I want to go back to Page. You know, there's a job that still needs to be finished. And, you know, I might not be, you know, in the business for as long as Hiroki will be in his now, you know, because I'm that much older. But there's a job still to be done. And I'm going to go back and do that. And he said, well, you can't. And I said, why is that? And he said, because you're in a wheelchair. And I think my response to that was something like, no shit. But, you know, I think I'd work that out. And he said, well, nobody will take you seriously. Nobody will see you. That absolutely confused me. You know, I mean, I just thought, right. I said, yeah, very good. Didn't want to fall out with him again and you know, and finish the call. And I just thought, that's just the most ridiculous thing I've thought. I don't see what the difference is. I was 6'4" before. I'm a lot shorter now. That's about the only difference. I can't see why being in a wheelchair, being disabled, you know, your faculties are intact, hopefully. I can't see why you can't, you know, go back and do the job. And I don't think anybody should or does think less of you because you have. So, you know, it felt reasonably natural, I suppose, to me. I sneaked in. You know, people knew I was coming back. They, you know, phoned me up and said, is there anything you need at work that, you know, that we might not have? Absolutely not. You know, it's all the same. We've got a disabled toilet, so I can get in there with a wheelchair. You know, everything else about the offices were fine. And I thought, I don't want people all sort of, you know, making a big deal of it. And I just sneaked in one day, you know, a week or so after coming out of hospital. And sitting in a flat on your own, you know, my fiance, who'd managed to take 4 months out off work to help me, she'd gone back to work. So I'm sort of sat in a flat on my own thinking, well, you know, my daughters are at work, you know, my fiance's at work. I could sit here and, I don't know, watch television or do emails, or I should just get crack on and get back into the office. And so I just jumped in a taxi. Well, not jumped, but got into a taxi and went to work and sort of rolled in and went into my office and you know, asked for a coffee and carried on from there.
It's interesting, Hiroki, just to talk to you a little bit about this, but that somebody thought that you wouldn't be seen because of the wheelchair, which is, I think, hopefully now very old-fashioned, outdated view of things. Did that cross your mind at all? I suppose with your business, you're talking to VCs, you're talking to investors, you're having to go and raise money and capital to grow the business at the pace that you want to grow it and so on. Was that a consideration for you at all around how you would be viewed reintegrating into your business? Were there things that you then specifically did or didn't do in order to make sure that, you know, you reintegrated in the way that you wanted?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was something that crossed my mind, probably more so than it did yours, Steve. You know, in the sense that, you know, I was worried about, you know, would I have the energy and the capacity to continue in my role. You know, and I think that, you know, I was fortunate in that I had all this support and you know, a lot of flexibility to go back and go back gradually, because I, you know, when I came out of hospital, I was still doing quite a lot of rehab. I was going to rehab like 3 times a week. The rehab was like a full day because, you know, it was 2 hours there, 2 hours back, you know, and then 3-4 hours of just rehab. So, you know, I was still kind of not 100% in the business when I went back, but I was able to go back gradually. And, you know, and then obviously once you start getting into the rhythm of things, you realize that actually, you know, it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't make any difference. And, you know, in many ways, I think that the experience that I've gone through has helped me to grow as a leader and to, you know, have different perspectives, which I value a huge amount. But one of the things that I've definitely thought a lot about is how lucky I've been, right? And Steve, I think you have as well, right? In that we were established enough in our careers, had enough of a support network around us, both, you know, personally and professionally, that we could, you know, go back in this kind of way. But I think one of the things that I've always kind of wondered about is, okay, well, what if this injury had happened when I was, you know, much younger, when I was 18, 19, or, you know, before I'd established myself? You know, that feels much more daunting, right? Because we had ready-made roles to go back to and support around us to make sure that we were able to go back in whatever way we felt best and most comfortable. You know, going and cracking into that from a standing start, that's a lot harder, I think. And, you know, I do think there's still some of that stigma out there, you know, that, you know, people, I don't think they, I always wonder, like, you know, if I was going and interviewing for a new job and I turned up in an interview in a wheelchair, you know, how would that go? You know, I don't know, is the honest answer. And so, you know, that is something that I think is important, that, you know, there is a continued change, right? I mean, definitely, I don't think it's as bad as it might have been 10, 20, 30 years ago, but I'm sure it's not as easy being in a wheelchair or having a disability as it is if you're not, right? You know, and so, and I know, Steve, this is something that you've been working on and thinking about a lot more. And I think that there's still work to be done.
Yeah. Steve, let's pick up on that. I hope you're doing a great job of segueing into the next questions that I was going to ask. But you wrote a letter a little while back to the government around the sort of mandatory reporting on disability pay gaps. And I know now, as a result of your accident, and, well, you know, and you're thinking more about that hidden talent and how people can kind of be empowered in their careers when they're disabled and so on. Do you want to just talk about your thoughts around that? What you think might need to happen?
Yeah, I mean, look, our whole purpose at Page is about changing lives. And you know, absolutely, what I've experienced with other patients in hospital as the starting point, and I've been introduced to a lot of people subsequently, you know, where people have put me in touch, would you speak to his or her parents, would you talk to her, you know, the person directly, you know, et cetera. So I've had so many conversations. I mean, literally, not quite daily, but certainly every other day. You know, one, I woke up to one on Monday, you know, 18-year-old, you know, in a taxi, whiplash. The pressure of that whiplash seems to have caused total paralysis from the neck down. 18 years old, you know. And as Hiroki says, I mean, you know, there's one thing going back to a job you've already carved out and got a reputation for. you know, aged 18, you know, all your mates are going off to university and you're suddenly thinking, I'm in a wheelchair and you know, electric wheelchair. And, you know, how would I possibly go off to university? I've only ever lived at home, you know, whatever. Horrendously challenging. You know, if they're going to be road bumps in the way, then we need to try to remove some of them, because it's crazy, because there are stats out there where, you know, 82% of people who aren't disabled work when they want to work. 50% of disabled people do, you know, and that's wrong. 14% of graduates are disabled. Only half of them will get a job. A third of them are advised to not state on their CV that they're disabled. Because I guess the career advisors are sort of saying, if you do, it'll probably, you know, prejudice your opportunity to get an interview. Well, that's hardly going to fill them with confidence going into the interview process. And then there are lots of other road bumps, because, you know, it's not just that are all offices accessible. You know, a lot of modern offices, frankly, are. But you've still got to live somewhere and you've still got to get to the office. So, you know, even with flexible working, you're going to go to the office sometimes. So you need to, you know, if it's got four steps, then you've got a problem. If there isn't a lift, you've got a problem, you know, et cetera, all the obvious things. But equally, you've got to live somewhere. And I came out of hospital and I was in a flat at the time in Marylebone on the third floor, no lift. And so I had to move. Now, I'd already bought a house, but that needed adapting. So I had to stay somewhere, trying to find a flat in London where there weren't steps, there was a lift, I could get to the flat, the door was wide enough to get through, and I could get it into the shower as well. It was very difficult. Now, I ended up borrowing a flat, which happened to be near Hiroki's offices, which made it a lot easier for us to meet each other.
Yeah.
But it was just a practical thing that made it really difficult. Now, so when somebody is disabled, and again, 80% of people get their disability during their lifetime. And I'm not just talking about spinal injuries. I'm talking about MS or, you know, blindness or whatever, all sorts of different disabilities. You acquire them during your lifetime. So you've got used to life, you know, in whatever way normal was before, and now you're disabled and you're having to get used to it. You've overcome challenges, you've had to demonstrate resilience, courage, whatever, creativity. I mean, some of the things that we have to overcome, you're constantly looking for solutions as to how to overcome them. All of those are skills you need. And yet, there's a 12% pay gap between those who are disabled and those that are abled. Why? For doing the same job, for the same performance, they're paid less. That is outrageous. And yet, probably that category of disability, which is 20% of the population, that pool of talent is being ignored, when actually they probably demonstrated fairly recently, when they got their disability, the key skills that we're all looking for as leaders to hire into a business: resilience, courage, you know, motivation, all of those sorts of things, a commitment. So, you know, yes, you can tell it slightly frustrates me. And that is something that I think, whilst at Page and maybe after Page, I can make a difference, or try to make a difference, with the help of people like Hiroki and other great role models, because Hiroki's more of a role model to somebody in their 20s and 30s than I am. But, you know, we've got to harness all of that to try to make a difference, because companies are missing out on it. There's a great pool of talent out there that could be used, you know, and that's then reflecting on the disabled people themselves, who've therefore got to try to forge out some other sort of life, which doesn't include all the benefits that come with working. Wrong. It's wrong.
Practically, Steve, in terms of changes that leaders can make in their businesses, and Hiroki, you'd be interested to see, you mentioned sort of post your accident, whether there's things that you've done as well. What would you say, well, look, these are the things you could actually start to do that will make a difference to those issues?
Yeah, no, well, I think it's fairly straightforward. First of all, you've got, as a leader, to make sure that you've got a diverse workforce that's totally inclusive, that makes everybody feel comfortable. They can be themselves, doesn't matter what whether it's something, you know, they've got a concern over their sexual orientation and don't want to admit it because they don't think it will be well received, or because they're a female in the business, or because they're disabled, or because, you know, they're black. It doesn't matter. Everybody should be feel they can be comfortable, they can be open about themselves and whatever their situation is. And, you know, that's something at Page that as soon as I became CEO, we committed to. Mm-hmm. To be honest, like a lot of corporates, we probably went for gender as the key issue at the time. And we focused on gender balance, and then we focused on sexual orientation, and then we focused on ability and race. And we started to do quite a bit of work on the area. To be honest, what's helped me think more about it is obviously I now understand a bit more about disability, which, to be honest, yeah, and I'll be very honest, I didn't really understand much about before. And so, you know, the knowledge I've gained in the last couple of years is now motivating me to do it more for disability in particular. But you've got to set the tone of wanting to have a more diverse and inclusive environment in your business. That's the starting point. The second is we should be measuring it in some shape or form. Where are we at? So, you know, at the moment, it's a requirement of companies to declare their gender balance and their pay difference, if there is one. And we're doing a lot of work in this area. We already publish it at Page, but we're doing a lot of work as well because the government asks you to publish it in a certain way, which I don't necessarily agree with. It doesn't really reflect the true picture. We're actually going to have a transparent way of doing it internally, so, you know, our staff can feel comfortable that there isn't a pay gap. But we should do the same for disability. And so, you know, the letters, a couple of letters now that I've written to our government here, absolutely says, well, look, you know, companies should admit where they're at. And then from the top, they should talk about what they want to do to change that and improve it. And to me, that's a great starting place. If we had those two things, and I think once we can start to give great examples of the success that companies have had recruiting more diversity into their business, you know, I feel, frankly, if there was somebody in a wheelchair in every one of our offices, John, then probably people would go, they would learn from that, and then we'll probably think, why isn't there two, why isn't there three, you know, and so on. So anyway, that's my view.
What about you, Roki, sort of post your accident? It's clearly a subject that Steve's passionate about, and that's brilliant. And working for a company with a leader that's got that is part of the reason I'm here. But have you become sort of more aware, and are there things that you're doing differently as a business at GoCardless now as a result of your experience and understanding more about the issue because you've had to?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would just echo Steve's emphasis on it being about diversity in a broader sense, right? I think that disability is just one dimension when it comes to diversity. And, you know, I think when I first had my injury, you know, the company was still a lot smaller. I think we were about 50, 60 people at the time. And, you know, to be honest, we hadn't really thought much about diversity and inclusion. It wasn't, you know, when you've got a company that small, and, you know, every day feels like it's more about like, okay, well, let's make sure we don't die. You know, you don't necessarily feel like you have the luxury of thinking about these things. But certainly the experience that I've had in acquiring my disability, you know, it's made me think a lot harder about, okay, well, actually, this is really important. And not only is it just important because it feels like the right thing to do, you know, Steve talked about a bunch of the stats, which just feel criminal. And that those stats can apply not just to disability, it can apply to lots of differences that we have in our societies. But also, I think it made me realize, okay, well, you know, actually having these different points of view is really valuable, right? I mean, I came back and saw the world in a different way. And, you know, a lot of the kind of things that you go through in, you know, adapting to being disabled are beneficial in terms of, you know, having those different perspectives, showing that resilience, that grit, the determination that you need, etc. And so, we started to take diversity and inclusion a lot more seriously as an organization after that. You know, we've been fortunate that we've been able to do this in quite an organic way. So, you know, we have groups within the organization that, you know, focus on different forms of diversity. So, you know, we have our BEAM group, which is focused on ethnicity. You know, our Rainbow group is focused on sexuality, etc. And you know, and so, you know, and actually, funnily enough, like we've kind of purposely done it in quite an organic way. And I was really pleased to see more recently that, you know, we actually formed a group focused on disability. We didn't actually have one. We have one for race. We have one for sexuality. We have one for females, but we didn't have one for disability. And, you know, I kind of made a point in my mind of like, I'm not going to do this on my own. I want the organization to do it. And so that was a really great moment when someone brought it up and said, hey, look, I want to lead this. So I think that you know, taking that diversity and inclusion is something that's really you take seriously, and, you know, aiming to try and build as diverse a group of people into your organization as possible, I think is a hugely beneficial thing. And then I think the other thing that's worth mentioning is, you know, there's a lot of great organizations out there, right, that you can work with to help you to do this. So I'm not sure actually, Steve, if it was Steve that introduced me to, there's an organization, Leonard Cheshire, and they are doing a lot of work and trying to get younger disabled people into the workforce, you know, running internships, things like that. And so they're partnering with organizations like that to not just kind of champion diversity and inclusion internally, but also engaging with the wider community to accelerate some of these things that, you know, are actual structural problems in our society, I think is the other thing that's really important. And obviously, as you scale, your ability to do that increases, which is great. And then I think that finally, the thing that I'm interested in seeing is, obviously, you know, the last year has been challenging for everyone, right, with the lockdowns and everyone having to work from home and all of these challenges. But I'm quite excited about what might come of that in the longer term, right? You know, we're changing the way that we think about being in the office, the way that we work. You know, it's something that we've been thinking a lot about internally, but I know that everyone else has as well. And, you know, my hope is that, you know, a lot of that is about providing more flexibility. And sometimes, you know, one of the things that I think can make a big difference, especially from the perspective of the disability, is that you might need a bit more flexibility, right? Like, it takes me a lot longer to get ready in the morning than it does someone else, right? So being able to, you know, adapt my day, maybe work from home more often, these are things that make a big difference. You know, it saves you a lot of time, enables you to be more effective. And so, you know, I think I'm quite intrigued as to what happens as the world moves to a bit more of an adaptive way of working. And, you know, I think that can be a great opportunity to bring more diverse kind of people into the workforce.
Thanks for that, Hiroki. You raised some fantastic points there around how COVID will affect things and so on. I think it's a subject that we're not going to quite get to delve into in the way that we might do if we had much longer. But just returning to the sort of the key theme of the leadership piece, just a sort of question for you each, and then one final question after that. But Steve, I'll come to you first. Post your accident, and it may be slightly a cliche question, but are there things, what's the one thing that stands out for you that you've learned about yourself as a leader and you know, I guess, yeah, as a CEO, and has that led on to something that you've changed in how you operate as a CEO?
Look, I think numerous is the answer. You learn a lot from being disabled and going through something as serious as this in your life. I'd like to think I'm more empathetic now and understanding of the different diversity that's out there, particularly relating to disability. You know, for example, and I think I forgot to mention it earlier, but there are a lot of leaders out there who don't admit a disability, but they have one. Because of course, we haven't mentioned this, but there are those that are obviously disabled. Hiroki and myself are two of them, because we've got a wheelchair under us. So it would take quite a lot for somebody to not realize we were disabled. But a lot of people who have disability, it's invisible. And so if the leaders are actually hiding their disability, you know, let's say it's mental health, you know, how are the employees of that organization going to feel about being open and honest about their own disability if their own boss can't admit it? And I think, you know, so again, we've got to be authentic as leaders. I'm disabled, so what? I mean, you know, as you say, we need a bit more flexibility sometimes, maybe, you know, it does take us longer in the morning to get ready or whatever. And there's just practical implications. Yeah, I can't run for a taxi, you know, so it's just going to take me a bit longer to get there. And you'd be amazed when it's raining. Frankly, they'll drive past you in a wheelchair because they have to get out and put the ramp out, which makes them wet. So, you know, you do get a mixed reaction. But so there's some practicalities. But I think the main learning, you know, is probably one of empathy and understanding. The second is time management, because I thought I was bloody good at time management before. You know, travel around a lot of countries and all this sort of thing, but trying to fit everything in that you've got to fit in around disability as well as doing that job is pretty challenging. And I agree totally with Hiroki. You know this, John, but we also have said it to the city, to shareholders. You know, we had a march this year that was nigh on as good as the march in 2019, with 1,000 less people. Our productivity per person in the business actually this March was higher than it's ever been in our history. And we did that with about 70% of our people working from home. And I've learned something from that, clearly. And I don't think there'll be many leaders around that haven't learned something from that. And that will definitely help companies that have, you know, an objective to do this, improve their diversity and inclusion. And as Hiroki said, that's not just about disability, that's about gender and so on. You know, a lot of females obviously choose to have a family, and that can make it difficult to balance a successful career and doing that. Well, flexibility around where we work from and everything else can really help. So, you know, this, I think, you know, when you look at the miserable year we've just come through, there's no doubt about it, there's a silver lining as well to that dark cloud, which is we've learned a lot about ourselves, our businesses and everything else, and hopefully that can reflect on the future.
Thanks, Steve. And then Hiroki, what have you learned about yourself since your accident?
Well, I mean, I'd say that the thing that I feel like I've learned is less about myself and more just generally about people, which is, you know, one of the things that I think has been the best sort of silver lining, I guess, of the injury that I've gone through is that I've met so many interesting people, you know, Steve being, you know, one of them. It's just left me with a huge amount of admiration for how resilient we can be, right? You know, people get through what sounds like horrific circumstances and they get out of the other side and they continue to live and, you know, continue to have great lives. That kind of gives me a huge amount of hope. I think that, for me, the main thing is about resilience.
Magic. Okay, grand stuff. Final question. See whether this stays in or not. You're both really physically active, physically fit guys prior to your injuries, and it seems like you've, I think Steve, you alluded to, you've kind of kept that up, and you naturally needed to keep that up in order to sort of be able to deal with what you're going through and so on. And Hiroki, I think Steve said you've got a 1-year-old now as well, which no doubt takes a bit of effort. So my question would be, and you may have already discussed this, depending on how many beers you'd had or not ever. Or whatever, 100-meter wheelchair race between the two of you, who wins?
I wouldn't be surprised if it was Steve. Steve is a pretty fit guy, and he has the benefit of being 6'4".
He used to like to flying around on two wheels. So you know, maybe he is a bit quicker. But I used to play a lot of rugby, so maybe I'd tackle him if he got too
far. Right, okay, if he got too far ahead, if you could catch him. Okay, cool. We'll call it time there, guys. Thanks ever so much for that. You've raised a number of fantastic issues there, and there's a number of things that we could talk about all day. But definitely your experiences, it's fascinating to see how that's shaped you as leaders, shaped you as CEOs, and may well help shape, you know, the future of how other CEOs go about their business as well. So thanks ever so much for your time, Hiroki. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Take care.
To hear more from our guests, including their extraordinary careers and expert advice, make sure you subscribe to the Career Chats podcast, available on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, to get the episodes as soon as they drop.